you all flown on.
Tickets are now on sale for Side by Side, Union Gallery's annual major fundraiser. Join us on Saturday, February 8th for an afternoon of live music, artsy activities, and a lottery-style draw where everyone is a winner. Take home a one-of-a-kind artwork and support Union Gallery's nonprofit mission. Come visit the exhibition or check out the online catalog to see the 100-plus works available. Head to uniongallery.ca and get your tickets for Side by Side today.
Good morning. You're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, CFRC.ca. I'm your host, Rue. We're listening to the CFRC live sessions, and we've got a very special guest in studio today. Seth from the Backsteps is joining us today, but it's just you today. You've come here solo.
I have. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you for having me here.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us. Yeah. So this is a sort of new era for you. Mm. It's you're not performing as the Backsteps today. Mm. You've come here because you're doing your own solo work, and you're playing a couple of tunes for us, acoustic.
Yeah.
But tell me a bit about the project. Is it a full band thing, but not the Backsteps?
I originally started the project. I was, the Backsteps took a little break from touring for a little bit. You know, Luke, our bassist, went back to school, and, you know, everybody else just kind of gets busy. So I just started writing these songs, and I actually live with our guitar player, Josh, and he's producing the new EP I'm working on right now. So yeah, we just started writing some tunes together, and they kind of started as like a more like folk acoustic type thing. And that's, you know, a lot of the music I was listening to when I was writing kind of revolved around like folk acoustic music, so that's kind of naturally what I started writing. And then a couple full band tracks kind of snuck their way in there, so... Yeah, for the shows I have booked, for some of them, it's just going to be me and an acoustic guitar. And then for the show we have next week at the Horseshoe in Toronto and a couple more, we're going to have like a full band just doing the same songs. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like a new kind of project. Yeah.
So it's sort of a new page turning over, but there's still like a bit of the Backsteps energy in there. Yeah. So is this your first full proper solo release?
Yeah. Yeah,
well,
this is
congratulations.
It. Thank you so much. Appreciate that.
A new EP.
Thank you.
A solo EP.
Yeah.
I'm hearing themes in it that are a little bit different from maybe what the Backsteps would do. Like, mm-hmm. the Backsteps, obviously, your songs are a bit more kind of like the group experience and, you know, about, I mean, you were telling me the last time that you were here about like the songs that the band wrote while you guys were on the road. And mm-hmm. it was like about your America trip and everything. Yep. How different is this EP?
It's pretty different if I'm being honest. When I was writing it, the goal was to try and be as open as possible and just try to kind of put everything on the table and just kind of writing what came naturally. So like when I pick up the guitar, if I was writing like a song about like, you know, a certain person or a certain situation or a certain relationship, just letting that happen instead of trying to maybe like force myself to write something different or something I, you know, necessarily didn't want to be writing, just having like, okay, this is how I'm feeling and this is what, you know, this is how the song's going to come out. And I think it made for a really honest and a very, this is such a cliche thing to sound, like almost like just like a super special EP to me. So it's like, it's all very personal and it's all, you know, everything's like real. It's based on like certain people or certain things or events. And I think that's kind of from the people I've shown the EP to or, you know, the guys that helped me work on it and things like that. It's made it a really enjoyable experience, but also... Yeah, it's tough to describe. I'm super proud of the EP, like lyrically especially. I tried to focus on writing, you know, the best lyrics I possibly could. And not to say I don't do that with the Backsteps, but again, it's a group thing, right? So you kind of each, like people kind of chip in different ideas. But for this, it's just kind of like, all right, this is how I'm feeling. And this is me pouring my heart out in whatever way to, I don't know who to appeal to, but yeah.
Well, you sound really excited about it. And that's already a really good sign.
Yeah, thank you.
Did you feel while writing it like there were maybe parts of your writing or parts of yourself coming out that you maybe couldn't talk about in the Backsteps, or that like, you know, doing this stuff on your own brought out something else that you hadn't maybe tapped into before?
Yeah, I've always tried to write as literal as possible. And I think with this EP, it's just kind of taking that to like another level. And I think a lot of it was the music that I was listening to while writing this. Like I got into some different bands that I had, you know, never really listened to. So if, like, you probably know every band I'm about to, but like Catfish and the Bottlemen was like a huge one Sam Fender. I really got into Fontaine's DC. Like, I really like, but I was really liking, especially Sam Fender, a lot of the lyrics I was hearing. And I was like, oh, you can write like a kind of upbeat sounding song, but have the lyrics be kind of, like, you know,
reflective,
kind of
heartfelt.
Reflective. Yeah, yeah. Super reflective. And even like Bob Dylan and Neil Young, and another one of my favorite songwriters is Paul Westerberg from The Replacements. And I think that's kind of like, we were practicing with the band for the show at the Horseshoe in Toronto next week, and the bassist was like, I like how we're just becoming like a knockoff Replacements. And I was like, honestly, this is what I'm feeling.
That's a compliment.
Exactly. It kind of feels like a bunch of doors opened when we started recording, and I felt super excited to be recording. You know, sometimes when you're playing in a group and you're so busy all the time, you can kind of lose that spark or that excitement. And then when I started kind of writing these songs and they started kind of flowing out, like that excitement like kicked back in, and like all the creative juices were flowing and booking shows again. So it's been a really nice transition.
Yeah. And you're going to play a few of the songs for us acoustic today.
Yeah.
So tell us about the first one you're playing.
The first one, working title is As We Were or As We Are. I haven't decided which one yet, but it's the first song I kind of wrote for the EP. I was sitting in my room. I'm always noodling on my guitar, and I had my guitar in my lap, and I was playing pretty basic 2-chord song, as most of the songs on this EP happen. I just kind of started scribbling down just different lyric ideas, and you know, for this one, I was thinking about a particular day where I was walking around with somebody, and we were hanging out, and I remember I was really hungover, and I was, you know, it wasn't my day. I wasn't feeling, you know, physically well, but mentally I was so happy. So just trying to write that down and just like basically get that feeling in a song where, hey, I don't feel good, but like mentally I'm, you know, I'm happy as I can be. So
incredible. We'll listen to that song and then we'll come back and talk a lot more about stuff.
Sure. Yeah.
So Seth Hunt here in CFRC.
Wind is cold and the leaves are brown, and we're both hungover as can be. We asked if I wanted to get breakfast. I gave you a band or a necklace. I told you I won't forget this day for weeks. Four walls of your house are my favorite place to be. I've been aching for a sense of security. Get in the car and tell them drive around. I tell you I'm gonna leave this town. You tell me my dreams are crazy and that's alright. You said how my dreams are made up. As you put on your makeup, it makes your face light up in city lights. Can I say a word to change your mind? I swear I'll change this time, I'll really try. Maybe one day we'll fall back in love. Forget all about the man I was. I still like booze, but I quit the drugs. And that's all I can do.
I'm Seth, and we just listened to my new song called As We Are.
And we're here on CFRC listening, getting a sort of sneak preview of Seth Hunt's brand new EP, debut solo EP. So tell me about getting into the studio to record it, because obviously it's different from, you know, the Backsteps process where kind of you guys have almost learned how to work in the studio together.
Yeah.
Like you've kind of come up learning that stuff together.
Yeah. It was nice because I recorded at my house. So that was nice. So, Josh, who plays guitar in the Backsteps, who's one of my closest friends, him and I lived together in Kingston here and set up like a studio in our living room. he produced and engineered and mixed and mastered the whole EP for me, and he was like amazing at, you know, being that extra set of ears that I kind of needed. So I mean, I guess from recording with like him and I, I've always collaborated really well together, so that it was nice having that element of like almost like comfort there. Yeah. And it was super like, you know, we're just creating something else together like we did in the back steps. But yeah, it was super nice. We could kind of work off our own schedule. And I feel bad for the poor guy too, because I would, you know, I'm very impulsively always thinking of ideas. And it was nice to not have like the time or the financial commitment to a studio where I, you know, you're kind of on somebody else's time and you can only throw so many ideas out. There was this EP. It was like we'd record one day, and if I thought of a new guitar part the next day, we could just...
You could just change it.
We could just go back and change it, which was fantastic. And it also made it like a super, like a stress-free recording process. And then there was even some songs on it, like we recorded drums for one, I think we did bass for one, but then I decided like, you know, maybe it wasn't quite where it could be, so we're just like, all right, well, let's throw it on the back burner for now. And even being able to do things like that, and it felt like I just had a lot of control over the project. And again, he was like, he was great with if I was, you know, maybe singing a line a certain way, he was like, hey man, like, why don't you try doing it this way? And it was always like really good feedback. So that was nice. And I feel like with this, with the recording of this EP, it was the most collaborative, oddly enough, that I've been with, like sending it to a lot of people beforehand, which is like before I would send it to like a handful of people and get a little bit of feedback. But for this, like as soon as I had the first single done, like I was sending it off to so many people just for like feedback and notes and this and that, which eventually led to more people kind of, you know, dipping their toes into the project a little bit, which was super cool. So a lot of Kingston bands and stuff had their say, which was
yeah,
super
I love
nice.
That. And, yeah. You know, them being Kingston,
yeah.
People will have a lot of ideas, a lot of yeah. feedback, and they're open with giving it as well.
Yep. Yeah, it was mm-hmm. great. It was fantastic.
Yeah, I think it, for you guys, pretty much would come from, like you said, less restrictions on when you can record. Mm-hmm. So it sounds almost like the production has basically become part of the songwriting process.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, which is cool. And again, with trying to kind of write the best lyrics I can, having the time to even go back and like change a word or, you know, yeah. a phrase, or, you know, if I'm driving one day to work and I think of a lyric that could fit really well, just shooting it over to Josh and being like, hey, like, we should change this line to this and see if it works. And I don't know if you've met him, or I don't know if he's ever been to the station, but he's probably the most laid back person. So he's like, yeah, whatever you want. Like, we could just
No, I think it was only you and Luke the last time.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It was just the two of you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he hasn't come in yet.
Not yet. No.
Maybe the next time.
Maybe the next
time.
Yeah, we'll get him here one day. Yeah.
For sure. So you're going to play us a second song for this session. Mm. But what I want to know a little bit about is, like, I was listening when you were recording it just to kind of to break the fourth wall a little bit. We do record the songs. Yeah. Before we do the interviews, and then we splice it together like magic. But yep. Listening to the second song, I was hearing a lot more sort of like character development and like narrative stuff and story building and all of that, which is maybe a bit different from what we hear in the back step. So I'm curious about that second song, like to choose to write it in that way.
Yeah, with that song, it was this. So the song's called Gabriella, and it's going to be the single. It's going to come out next, I don't know when this is going to air, but February 7th, so next Friday from where we are now. And that one came like super quickly and naturally. And that was one where we recorded it, and it was one of the ones where we recorded it, and it was like,
you immediately know you've got that hook. You've got that chorus.
Yeah. And like the lyrics, they just were, they came really easily. And, you know, that was one where it was like, okay, we don't need to add anything. This song is good the way it is. And that one's like a full band song. But yeah, writing the lyrics to that one was fun and not fun, if I can be honest, because it was like I was trying to, you know, I wanted to write something that was about a certain person that I know, and basically trying to be like as like
descriptive about it.
Stealth, but like at the same time, like if they were to hear it, they would know exactly like, oh my, come on, man, seriously. But no, so there was like a lot of kind of something I've never really done before in a song is use like quirky references or like real references almost to like, you know, there's like introducing like met a girl from Malibu, she lives in Syracuse. It's like very literal, like it's very like this is who she is.
But also on the other hand, to anyone who, you know, isn't involved in this world, believable fiction.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that was something I was kind of nervous about when I was writing it, but I sent it to my buddy Ryan, who's playing bass. He plays bass in a band called Pound Salt, and he's playing bass for some of the live shows coming up. And I sent it to him, and immediately he was like, I'm not in the situation of the song. But he's like, but you can still relate to the song and how somebody's feeling. Because it's like, even if that's not you 100%, it's like, okay, well, somebody's probably gone through something similar, or mm-hmm. just likes the descriptive, like,
yeah,
descriptive, you know.
The Bruce Springsteen philosophy, basically.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And, you know, I heard this quote that kind of stuck with me for the writing the lyrics of the EP, and it was, if the root of the song is good, then that means the song is good. And that's kind of stuck with. So with that song, it was like, the lyrics are good, the bare bones of the song are good, let's not overcomplicate things, and let's just make, like, a really kick-ass.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes the simplest stuff sounds the best.
I agree.
And we're going to hear a stripped-down version of it right now.
Right now.
So, Seth Hunt, Gabriella, here on CFRC.
From Malibu, and now she lives in Syracuse. She's just here while she's finishing her school. Her dad's a famous actor and her mom's a chiropractor. Don't ask me why she's playing the fool. Because she's gonna get some money, because guess what, buddy, that's what rich and famous people like to do. She's never gonna talk to me again, so I'll force myself to pretend that I never even liked you. Do you like my broken smile? Do you like my crooked teeth? Do you like the way I sing, the way I dance, the way I talk when you're not sitting next to me? Actor, but she can't remember his name after she's had a couple of drinks. She said it was Ewan McGregor. I said, what the hell? I've never heard that line before. Do you like my broken smile? Do you like my crooked teeth? Do you like the way I sing, the way I dance, the way I talk when you're not sitting next to me? Like the way I look at you when you're top casting, and I'm gaslighting to reaction, falling off the wagon. We were both still in love. Do you think about the days wasted off the years taken of a heart shaped hole? It'll always be vacant. Do you miss the days where I was the number? Do you like my broken smile? Do you like my crooked teeth? Do you like the way I sing, the way I dance, the way I talk when you're not sitting next to me?
Seth, and that was my new song, Gabriella.
We're here live on the CFRC Live Sessions. Seth is our guest today, and you're going on tour soon as well with your new EP. Do you have a name for the EP yet?
I do not have a name for the EP yet. If you guys have any ideas, please.
Kingston is collaborative. They will reach out.
I was going to say, somebody send it to me.
Also, tell me about the tour, because you're going sort of on a, from what I can see, like an East Coast kind of tour.
Yeah.
There are a few Canadian stops. There are also a few U.S. stops. Mm-hmm. What do you expect from the shows?
I'm really looking forward to the Horseshoe next week, and that's like the big project tour launch kickoff thing. That's going to be like a full band. Then, so I grew up in Gananoque, so just right outside of Kingston. They have like this beautiful theater there called the Royal Theater, so I'm doing a show there right after the Horseshoe, where it's going to be like acoustic, but I'm going to have like special guests come up. So like some of my hometown friends are going to come up and play like a song or two, and then like somebody else's song or two. So it's going to be like just a really fun night of having a bunch of different musicians and artists and things like that. And then, yeah, leave for the States maybe 2 weeks after, something like that. But it's going to go Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Cleveland. I want to say we're working Washington right now, but there's still a couple of things that need to be done. And then when we get back, like, you know, we're going to announce a show up like up in Ottawa and, you know, possibly like a Kingston date or two in there. So, yeah, that tour is just going to be me and the acoustic guitar going through the States. Then when I get back to Canada, we're going to do like the full band.
Full band, again, that
makes
sense.
Kind of trade back and forth. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that's super cool. I'm excited to kind of, you know, talk a little bit about like at the shows about like the songwriting process a little bit more and kind of, you know, again, just have that interaction with the audience. And I'm also excited to go to some cities I've never been. And I love food when I tour. So go to check out some restaurants and things like that.
Yeah, I remember your travel food blog.
I need to bring that back, I think.
Yeah, it would be good on a tour like this.
I think so. Yeah, it's funny. I did that and then I retired it in like a weird fashion. And then I just like, yeah, I have so many videos on my phone of like us and the band like making food and like doing dumb things, like eating at a bunch of restaurants. But yeah, it'll be back. Don't worry. It's
great. I think I'm waiting for that almost as much as the tour.
Me too. Yeah, seriously. Yeah.
Okay, do we have a release date for the EP?
I can give like a rough timeline. I know the first single is going to be the 7th of February, and then second one I normally do like 3 weeks after. But I'm thinking EP, we're gonna shoot for April.
Okay.
Like mid-April release. That would be the tour is done. We have a little bit of like hype, and then we can even do like an EP release party in Kingston. That's kind of my plan. But like after the tour is over, have that momentum and then bring it home kind of thing.
That would be a good homecoming as well.
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. And so we have two last songs that you're going to play us.
Yep.
I'm guessing that's like most of the EP that you've already played for us.
Yeah, that's the EP. And then there's one cover on the EP, Slide Away by Oasis. I love that song. It is such a good song. And we're doing it as like a full band at like the live show. Noel Gallagher was another huge inspiration for some of the melodies on the EP. And, you know, so I was like, yeah, let's just kind of give an ode to Oasis. I mean, I'm sure they would hate it.
Oasis have heard BMTH's cover of Wonderwall.
Yeah.
So I think they'll definitely be able to live with your version.
I was going to say, let's send it right to Noel when we get the clip up. Just send it to him. Yeah.
Well, we've got two more songs.
Yeah.
I'm hearing a bit more almost like country music on it. Tell me about the last, that's on the last song, right? Sounds a little bit more country.
Yeah. I listen to a lot of a lot of different kinds of music. Like obviously I love punk music and things like that, but I listen to a lot of folk music. Like I love Wilco, the earlier Ryan Adams records, like Heartbreaker. And I got really into Zach Bryan for a little bit there, like almost like Americana, but then it kind of took me back to like the Eagles and things like that, where you kind of have like a rock to even like the hip, like rock kind of country twang vibe. And you know, I recently discovered my Fleetwood Mac side. Which I don't know why I've never even entertained listening to Fleetwood Mac nothing against them until like this past year. And I was like, I've been missing out on like so much, but there's like kind of having that twang. And I think again, just kind of when I was like naturally writing, it was like what I was listening to. And yeah,
gives your EP a little bit more depth.
Yeah,
something
exactly.
Different going on.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What are the last two songs called?
One of them is called Caffeine and the other is called West Side Highway.
Yeah. Okay, amazing. Yeah. And those are the last two we're going to listen to for today. But let's recap for anybody who's listening in. Seth, you're going on tour starting on the 7th.
Yeah.
That's going to be your Toronto show. Mm. Then you've got a couple of other shows around Ontario. Mm. You're going down to the US. Mm-hmm. Singles coming out on the 7th.
Yep.
That's the first one.
Yeah.
And then hopefully we'll see you when you guys do the Kingston show.
Yes, 100%. We've been in touch with like a couple different venues. So if it all goes according to plan, we'll have something right when we get back.
Amazing. Well, congrats again on your debut EP.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
We'll see you soon.
See you soon. Thanks.
Deny it. Things didn't work out and that's okay. I can't think about it. My brain races and I don't know what to say, except I miss you and to come home. I'm scared to face that I've never been alone, alone. And I love the Beatles more than you, so why do you fight me on it? I love caffeine more than you, it just makes you sick and tired. I love everyone more than you, so why do you even try? Why do you even try? Tell me about it. Did you get that pay raise at your job? Are you excited? How's your family? How's the family dog you got when you and your sisters were kids? Scared to look at all the things we did. I love the Beatles more than you, so why do you fight me on it? I love caffeine more than you, it just makes you sick and tired. I love everyone more than you, why do you even try? I love the Beatles more than you, so why do you fight me on it? And I love caffeine more than you, it just makes you sick and tired. And I love everyone more than you, so why do you even try? And I love the Beatles more than you, so why do you fight me on it? And I love caffeine more than you, it just makes you sick and tired. The West Side Highway isn't the place to fall in love, especially when you're homesick and drunk. Look in your eyes is telling me that you don't care. Let's look at the city and talk about the billionaire. Well, don't push me out, I'm the only one that's here for you. Oh, oh, oh. Don't leave me here, 'cause I'm wasted and confused. Take me home. Oh, oh, oh. Please take me home. Oh, 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 with you. The West Side Highway isn't the place to raise a kid, especially when you're poor, you're not rich. You had some fun here when you 21. Now you wanna live in the town where I came from. Silence is so loud, you wanna scream. Well, don't push me out, 'cause I'm the only one that's here for you. Oh, oh, oh.
Hey, my name is Seth Hunt, and you are listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
Bruce Kuwabara celebrated Canadian architect and the mind behind Agnes Reimagine, the new home of the Agnes Etherington Art Center, is this year's Francis K. Smith Lecturer in Canadian Art. In his talk, Catalyzing Change, Kuwabara presents several recent projects that explore the themes of art and community and the insights he gained working on Agnes Reimagined. Join us on Thursday, March 20th at 6 p.m. in Grant Hall for this exciting event. Tickets are free, but please register by visiting agnes.queensu.ca.
Today on Wings, Australia's Women's Circus. Founded in 1991, the Women's Circus calls itself a tool for fostering positive community. To hear about the history of women in circuses and the Women's Circus's work, stay tuned.
I think it's really refreshing if you're there and you see immediately that there's no trick involved, that people can perform these amazing stunts and use their bodies in the most amazing ways without special effects, you know, through hard work, through training, and that they can do things you never even dreamed of.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
I'm Sheila Ryan. Today on the program, we're running away to the circus. To be honest, I never really understood the excitement that was generated by the circus coming to town. It might have something to do with my childhood memories of sitting in an airless tent on a hot Brisbane day, watching clowns doing juggling acts and seeing women in leotards leading pretty sad-looking animals through their tricks. But in the last few years, I've noticed very different types of circuses emerging, so I thought maybe it was time for another visit.
Well, how I always think of it is it's safe risk-taking. You know, you don't go to the extreme of going, I'm just going to throw myself into these places. You know what all of the end results of those places are going to be. You make it so you do feel liberated, but it's in a really strong, positive way.
That was Francesca Scully from the Women's Circus, and you'll be hearing more of that interview later in the program. I'll also be speaking to Ebony, who's a graduate of the National Institute of Circus Arts, and that's Australia's first accredited institution that provides training in contemporary circus arts. But first, I wanted to find out about the history of circus, so I spoke to Nicola Brackertz, a lecturer in circus history at Swinburne University. I started by asking where circus is thought to have originated.
I think entertainments that we see in the circus, they've been around for thousands of years, like the ancient Greeks, the ancient Romans, and especially the Chinese have a long tradition of, you know, acrobatics, juggling, and even horse tricks. But the way they say that the modern circus, which is now, of course, not quite so modern anymore, started is in England in 1768 with a guy called Richard Astley. And he had been in the army with the cavalry, and so he was a very accomplished horseman. And after he left the army, he settled in London, and he set up initially a riding school. And then in order to get more business, he started showing equestrian tricks and included also clowning and acrobats and jugglers and later on also tightrope walkers to his program. And from Astley, circus quickly spread around Europe to France, also spread to America. And in the sort of mid-19th century, circus also came to Australia, and I think there were a few sort of isolated incidents of people trying to put on tightrope performances, but it was only when the gold rushes sort of started, suddenly a lot of money came into Australia and people, you know, spread from the main centres to the regional areas, and they sort of were looking after entertainment that sort of could travel with them.
What would life have been like in those early circuses as a performer living on the road?
It would have been very, very hard physically, I think. You would have to travel long distances in very poor road conditions with very primitive kind of transport. Your income, of course, wasn't almost guaranteed. You were at the mercy of the elements. The circuses also started off relatively small initially in that sort of gold rush period. They were often family-based, and I think especially for the women, it was very hard. Infant mortality was very high. The women were expected to be part of the performances, also, you know, perform their duties in terms of cooking, looking after animals, pitching in with the travelling, and of course then, you know, childbearing and looking after the children as well. I think it would have been very strenuous.
You mentioned that horses were a big part of the early circus performances, but you have these images of elephants and tigers and all sorts of animals being involved in circus. When did they become incorporated?
Well, in Australia, circus sort of started off initially replicating what was going on in England, and it was first based around the horse. And I guess if you also think about the economy, it was mainly based around the horse. There weren't any cars. People were very familiar with horses. They appreciated how difficult an act might have been. And sort of initially they had some smaller animals, like they might have had performing pigs or monkeys. And then, of course, if you think again, that, you know, in an era where you don't have TV and animal documentaries and sort of wild animals are something really exotic and strange, this started to become quite popular to have sort of zoos or animal menageries. But this sort of travelling with wild animals that are part of the circus, like you might think of the big cats or elephants or sort of exotic animals like that that go with the circus, that didn't really become popular until later in the century. And I think that was something that was also really popularised by a big American circus.
There's the old joke about running away to join the circus. Mm. How did people become circus performers? I know a lot of circuses were family-based.
Yeah, I think initially it was predominantly family-based, but people did run away to the circus. I mean, there were a lot of incidences where young children would be adopted into the circus. And, well, there's, you know, always allegations that they were kidnapped, but I don't think that was so particularly common. But I think it's more like mothers who weren't able to look after their children might give their children to the circus. And in Australia especially, there were many Aboriginal children who joined the circus. I think when Aboriginal society was already being very disrupted by white, well, settlement or invasion, you might say, and the living conditions weren't always very great for them. And so it was actually an avenue for Aboriginal children to go into the circus, to be trained as circus performers and make their life there. And there were quite a few very famous and very well-regarded Aboriginal circus performers. A rider, Harry Cardella, who was really very well-regarded sort of in the earlier days. And you might have heard of Concolino, who was, of course, the internationally famous wire walker, who was also of Aboriginal descent.
And what about women performers? Were there many female star performers?
Yeah, there were. Like, for example, again, with Burton Circus. Burton came out initially from England. He had trained there, and he came here together with his wife. Her name was Madame Rosina, and she had been an equestrian star at Astley Circus, at the first circus. And they came out here to set up the circus, and she was the star attraction in his show. And, I mean, as you know, initially during the gold rushes, the ratio of men to women wasn't that great, so there weren't that many women around. So having a female performer in your show, that was a good attraction for starters, you know, because the men wanted to come and see a female performer. But because it was based on the family unit, it was usually the husband, the wife, and their children.
So what sort of performances would the women and girls do?
Okay, well, again, we're talking about equestrian acts initially, so the woman might have been dressed up in a dress with a voluminous skirt and have performed on a cantering horse. As you might imagine, a voluminous skirt sort of restricts the kind of acts you can do. So the kind of things that they would do is jump over hoops or through hoops or jump over canvas pieces that would be held by assistants as the horse is going around the circle. They might do some posing, or they might be part of a lifting act where maybe the man is on the horse and then lifts the woman up into the air to strike a certain pose, these kinds of things.
There was one quite famous Australian female performer. Could you tell us about her?
Yep, there was a very famous female performer. Her name is May Worth. She was born in 1894 in Bundaberg in Queensland. She was the daughter of, you know, small-time circus performers. Her father was an acrobat and an alcoholic, which meant that life for her wasn't that easy, and for her mother especially wasn't very easy because he was an abusive alcoholic. But May started training at a very young age to do contortion and acrobatics. But sort of after a few years, May's mother really couldn't stand it with her husband anymore, and she leaves her abusive husband and she gives May up for adoption. May's mother thought she couldn't look after May properly, so she adopted her out to Worth Circus, which was...
So a company would legally adopt a child?
Yeah, the company would. I mean, the family was the company. Mm. So this Worth Circus, which was based on the Worth family, adopted May, and that's how she got her name, May Worth. So she became part of the company, part of the family. She grew up with the other Worth children, with their real children. But this was good and bad for May. It was bad in that she had to leave her actual family, but it was good in that she suddenly went from being, you know, a poor girl in a sort of lowly kind of circus family to being part of the most powerful and large and respected circus family at the time, where she had access to an education, to excellent trainers. She became a fantastic horse rider, and she sort of took horse riding for women from this sort of posing on horses and jumping over things and doing tricks like this to performing much more acrobatic stunts on the back of the horse, something that previously only men had done. She could do amazing things like do a somersault from one galloping horse, somersault onto the back of another galloping horse that was going behind it. She would do this amazing trick where she would tie baskets to her feet, run up, jump on top of the horse with the baskets on her feet and balance on the horse.
So would it have been seen as a fairly liberating and exciting career for a woman?
That's a very difficult question. I think it was liberating in that you might have had more freedom to express yourself physically and to do something. As liberating in that circus in general was set apart from society a little bit. But May, for example, she, I think it was in 1912, she went from Australia to America, where she performed for John Ringling, who was sort of the agent and owner of the largest circus there, the John Ringling Barnum and Bailey's Circus. And she started there as the major star. She was advertised in big flashing lights as the champion wizard rider. But in order to do these acrobatic acts that she was doing, she really needed to change the costume, because these kinds of things couldn't be done with a voluminous skirt. So May adopted a sort of trademark look when she went to America, which was she had her hair bobbed quite short with a big pink tie. But she did away with these sort of voluminous costumes and sort of had a small sort of tunic like costume that was relatively tight fitting. It was only about knee length and sort of slit at the thigh, which gave her really good movement and ability to do her things. There's a long history of women having sexy outfits when they perform. I'm sure there was an element of that, but I think it was really a practical consideration. You know, she always said she wanted to do what the boys did, and in order to do that, she really needed to make some changes.
How was circus regarded? Was it seen as a lower class form of entertainment, or was it more of a fringe form of theatre?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because I think that's something we think about a lot today. I don't think it was really regarded as, let's say, high art, as like, say, the opera or something like that, but it was most certainly not a fringe form of entertainment, especially if you're looking at like the 1920s. That was often called the golden age of the circus. It drew massive crowds. When a circus came to a country town, for example, you know, the shops might very well close for the day to allow everyone to come and see the circus. And people looked forward to it, I think, all year, because if you're thinking, again, you don't have television, you don't have as many diversions as you have today. So if something comes to your town, too, it sort of breaks the monotony of your yearly cycle, and you know, sort of it suspends reality for those few days that it's there.
What have been some of the really significant changes to circus over the years?
I think the strength of circus is that it's a really living art form. It changes and mutates as society changes and what people want to see changes. And so, you know, it's gone from being really based around the horse, which is what it was about initially, to starting to incorporate these wild animal menageries when people wanted to see this. Always has been keen to adopt to technical change. So when new modes of transport were invented, for example, the trains, the circus took to the rails, which allowed it to, you know, travel faster, more comfortably, have more gear, have more animals, all these sorts of things. And also with audience tastes, you know, as first the animals come in because they're very exotic and people want to see it, then this awareness of animals, you know, animal acts may be cruel, so animals sort of recede a little bit. The interesting thing, I think, today is that there are parallel streams of circus going on, where you're looking at shows like, say, Cirque du Soleil or Circus Oz, who don't use any animals. But the traditional circus continues today. You get shows like Silvers or Ashton's, and they do use animals. And I think it's now the sort of more trendy circus that's moving back into the theatres, back into sort of cabaret, and there's a lot of that happening at the moment. But, you know, the more traditional versions of it, they persist, I think.
Why do you think now, when we seem to be saturated with so many other forms of popular entertainment, that circus seems to be making this revival?
I think it's because it's very real. Like, we get so many special effects and we're so used to seeing, like, the most outlandish, outrageous things happen and being sold to us for real on TV and in all these other media, that I think it's really refreshing if you're there and you see immediately that there's no trick involved, that people can perform these amazing stunts and use their bodies in the most amazing ways without special effects, you know, through hard work, through training, and that they can do things you never even dreamed of being possible, and you're there to witness it and you can have a connection to the performer. I think it being immediate and it being real and it being there allows people to sort of make a connection with it.
That was Nicola Brackert, who's a lecturer in circus history at Swinburne University of Technology.
You are listening to a program about women and circuses, produced by Women on the Line at Community Radio 3CR in Melbourne, and shared with WINGS, the Women's International News Gathering Service. Again, here's host Sheila Ryan.
The days of having to run away or be born into a circus are in the past. Now you can run away to university and do a degree in circus arts. Next on the program is Ebony, who's a graduate of the National Institute of Circus Arts, and I caught her during a break in rehearsals for her next show. First, I asked her how she got into the NICA course.
They'd like you to have a background in gymnastics, dance, acrobatics, tumbling, skateboarding, roller skating, juggling, any of those backgrounds, and you have to go through a hard process of auditioning and show an act. Like, either it depends if you're doing the drama side, you have to show a dramatic act, or if you're doing the physical side, a physical act.
And I understand that hundreds of people audition.
Yeah, thousands, and it's every state in Australia there is an audition, and so they get quite a lot of people, so they have to turn quite a lot of people away.
What's the training involve? Are you trained in a particular circus art, or are you trained in a broad range of arts?
Every day is training flexibility, tumbling, strength, and handstand. And now each day on each thing, and then we go into what our specialty act wants to be, and we get to choose two acts, and within those the 3 years you get to train and dedicate a lot more time so that when you do leave you have two acts that are ready for performing to a live audience.
And what's your act?
My act's the cloud swing.
Is that what I've been watching here? There's been some people dangling from large pieces of fabric suspended from the ceiling. Is that your...
No, that one's the tissue. Mine's it's like a big giant swing. Okay. In the air, and you wrap your body around it and move around it however you like.
Whereabouts are your trainers from? What's their background?
Oh, the trainers here are fantastic. There's trainers from all around the world. China, Argentina, Russia, Australian, Bulgarian. All of them pretty much had a background in circus.
And what attracted you in particular to a career in circus?
Well, I auditioned in Darwin. I'm originally from Darwin. And I did gymnastics for 15 years. So with the physical background in gymnastics, it helps a lot. And in Darwin, we don't really get to see much circus at all because it's so far away from all the other states. I thought, it's a university degree. I get to learn and train at the same time. I love doing physical stuff.
And do you feel that this is a genre of the arts where men and women have equal ability and equal career opportunities?
I think definitely so, because it's about physical endurance and stuff, but it's also about how you interpret it. If you're strong, that doesn't matter. It's how you use that muscle or how you use it on the stage and perform it to the audience.
A lot of circus, I imagine, relies on collaboration and teamwork. Did you form strong relationships with the other members of your year as you were going through the course?
Most definitely, because you spend 10 hours a day, 5 days a week with them, and also because you're from interstate, weekends as well, and they become like your brother or sister.
Which is quite nice, really, when circus has this tradition of it being a family sort of business as well.
Yes, definitely, because you spend so much time with each other, you can be honest with each other and get the job done.
Have you found work as a circus performer?
Yes, I had a 3-month contract with the Weber Brothers Circus in New Zealand on a show called Splash. That's a traditional circus, so it's a little bit different to my contemporary act that I put together, but I still got to do my cloud swing act. And I've just been overseas in Europe, just auditioning for other circuses.
And so are there fairly good career prospects for circus performers?
I think so. I think if you want to get it, it's out there. If you're dedicated and if you love it, that's the main drive.
That was Ebony, a circus performer with the National Institute of Circus Arts. On community radio around Australia, you're listening to Women on the Line. Next on the program is Francesca Scully, who trains and performs with a slightly different circus, the Women's Circus, which is based in Melbourne.
The Women's Circus was founded now about 15 years ago by Donna Jackson. She had an idea for a show. It had a bit of circus in it. What she noticed from doing that show was that a lot of women changed their perception about their bodies. A lot of the women in the show at the time were survivors of sexual assault, and what they talked about was that they started to feel more present. And so from that, and from the impetus of other women's circuses that were formed in the 70s, she had the idea to start the Women's Circus, and it's still going now. And we still have priority groups, which are survivors of sexual assault, women over 40, and women from non-English speaking backgrounds. The training program is open to all women. Essentially, it's a circus training program. It's a physical theatre group, and we do a show based around art, with some of the benefits being that some people begin to feel really present in their bodies.
So for someone like me who's never been to see a women's circus performance, what might we expect to see?
A whole range of different stories, different skills. Often there's music, there's quiet moments, there's acrobatic stuff, and there's stories. We really tell stories through circus, mostly. It's not just about the trick, say. It's about storytelling.
So how many women are involved in the, say, the end of the year performance?
There can be up to about 120 women involved, and that's, you know, front of house, back of house, on stage. So there's a lot of bodies involved in making the shows at the end of the year.
Why do you think circus in particular lends itself to expressing a feminist philosophy?
You know, there's that childhood dream that you run away and join a circus. And you see people doing circus, they're strong. They're really strong in their bodies. And so in terms of the feminist ideals, I suppose that seeing women represented in a really strong, positive way, you're not there for any other reason than to achieve this goal of, you know, a trick really at the end of the day. So I think that's the idea of it.
And some of the acts that circus performers do, like juggling and balancing acts, you could draw analogies between that and the role that women often have to play in a societal context.
I think you can read lots of things into it, but when you're on the floor and when you're training, I think a lot of that falls away, because you're really, you can't be thinking about juggling your whole life, because you have to be really present in the moment. If you're high up on a trapeze, you can't be going, I've got to do the shopping, I've got to pay my bills, I've got it. You actually really have to be very there, sitting on that trapeze, knowing where your feet are, knowing where your hands are, and everything
forces
else
you to shut out the rest of the world.
Yeah, there's nowhere else to go in it. You have to be there.
Now, you are a performer and a trainer.
Yeah.
How did you get involved with the Women's Circus?
Well, I joined as a training member in 2001, and, you know, a lot shifted in my body. So I became more aware, and I started doing other training in yoga and other forms of movement, and then started working with my trainer then, Andrea Owsley, who's gone on to do social circus at Nika. And so I started working with her alongside her and teaching. And then I've just kind of gone in through the little pathways and ended up being a trainer as well and recreating that philosophy. So I teach induction of new women to the circus. We're taking this year, we're taking up to 120 women into the circus, and then it can be outreach projects as well. And a lot of the women are involved in teaching the new women that come into the program and doing that, teaching the outreach.
So tell us about the outreach program. How does that work?
Well, the outreach program is really an extension of what the Women's Circus is, which is kind of a core philosophy about training your mind, body, spirit. So lots of organisations, schools, independent organisations, corporations will call us and say, we're having this day, or we're really interested in doing a circus program. And then what we'll do is we'll find out why they're doing a circus program, and then we'll tailor make their workshop to what the group is. Essentially, we use all the same things that we would use in our own training program, but we just tailor it to that particular group.
And what might be some of the reasons why they're doing the workshop?
A lot of people say it's for team building, to build self-esteem, to have an afternoon where they're not at work, where they're working together in a different way.
In other forms of theatre, there's a writer and a director who are having input into how the show is put together. How are your shows developed?
Well, we've got an artistic director. Donna Jackson has actually come back, and she is now our artistic director. She'd manage all of the production teams. In terms of developing material for the show, someone might come up with an idea, depending on how much time we've got to create the show. last year, Donna came up with the idea, and then it was a collaborative process to make the work that goes into the show. Often we have, earlier on in the year, a research day where people bring material to the idea of the show, and then it gets developed from there. But there is a huge process that goes into that, often collaborative.
What was the show you put on last year?
It was called Daddy. It was 50 women in drag impersonating their fathers or characters that they've seen in their fathers. Very fun, telling stories of our fathers. And we'll do another show at the end of this year.
At the end of this year.
Yeah.
The term circus is often used to describe something that's chaotic or disorganised, but in fact, circus requires incredible precision and focus. Is it difficult to find a balance between wanting to express yourself with your body and the incredible control and discipline that's required of a circus performance?
Well, how I always think of it is it's safe risk-taking. It's not about jumping off the top of the building without a support to catch you at the bottom. It is a fine balance, but they go hand in hand. You know, you don't go to the extreme of going, I'm just going to throw myself into these places. You know what all of the end results of those places are going to be. You make it so that you do feel liberated, but it's in a really strong, positive way, because should you jump off that building, you're going to splat, and kind of defeats the purpose. So I think discipline's a positive thing as well.
Mm.
It really teaches us how to structure and move through our life.
One of the priority groups you mentioned that you work with are survivors of sexual abuse. How does circus performance benefit these women in particular?
Well, I guess we're primarily a physical arts company, and people notice benefits in their bodies. So Donna's often referred to this thing where she's talked to a lot of people before she started the circus, and lots of people were talking a lot about their abuse or going to see therapists and talking a lot, which is really useful, of course. But what she was saying is that what happens to the rest of your body in that time, it's just all in your head. It's just all this head stuff that's going. But if you start moving your body physically, and not just for circus, but for in any other way, that you get to kind of channel that energy outwards and away. And so you start to become more present in your body. You start taking ownership of your toes and your feet, and your body becomes back your own. And with survivors, I suppose the first thing that you do is detach yourself from your body. So I think the benefits of doing something like circus is that you have to be present in your body and reclaim ownership over that body. We're not counsellors. We always encourage people that they need other support, but this is one way of being able to re-inhabit your body and just be present and move forward.
What are some of the positive transformations you've seen in women in the time that you've been a trainer with the Women's Circus?
It's been a really varied thing. For some people, they've realised that they're much better at being a techie than a performer. You know, that they've gone through maybe a bit of a training process and gone, no, that's not necessarily what I want to do. A powerful thing is being able to make choices for yourself. One of the great transformations is actually seeing people be a lot clearer about what they need for their own bodies and what they want to do. I see that a lot, actually. The other thing, seeing people achieve something, whether it's tiny or whether it's like a massive thing. Some people just can stretch further or can move further. Those shifts, while from the outside might not seem that big, are really huge for people.
That was Francesca Scully from the Women's Circus. And that's the program for this week. I hope you've enjoyed our visit to the circus. Women on the Line is Community Radio's national women's current affairs program. It's produced and presented by a range of women broadcasters from 3CR in Melbourne, and it's distributed nationally via the Community Radio Network Service of the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia. The music you've been listening to is called Wonderful Tonight by Noonday Underground, and the theme music for Women on the Line is Kerri-Ann Cox's She's Got a Story Too. I'm Sheila Ryan.
So make you happy, so make you sad, so make you cry, so make you mad.
The program you just heard was recorded in 2006, but Australia's Women's Circus and its National Institute of Circus Arts are still going strong. Wings thanks Women on the Line and 3CR Radio for this shared content. Thanks also to all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, whose salons can be viewed at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's all.